For July the 31st, 2020, we talk about Carrion, the Nintendo Giga Leak, and we ask you about your favorite diegetic interfaces. Welcome to Level 338. My name is Cole Ross.
I'm Dennis Furia.
My name is David Meismeth.
And I'm Ben Merkel.
And you are listening to The Level. It's a podcast for people who love video games. First thing, we'd like to extend what is by now a belated happy birthday to Jala. It is her birthday as of the time we record. It'll be a few days ago as of the time this comes out. So I don't have a party blower or anything here, but yay, happy birthday. Second, I want to do a little bit of a disclaimer. I bit my tongue at some point in the past 24 hours. Ooh. And there's like a little tender area on the side of my tongue that is making it hard to say certain words. So if I sound a little bit more lispy today, or if I restart a word or go, ow, I just bit that part of my tongue that hurts. I just bit the part of my tongue that hurts.
Can you give us 20 examples of words that are hard to say for you right now?
No, I'm mostly stumbling across them by accident. It wasn't this bad when we were recording WAF earlier today, but that was 4 hours of talking ago. So
if you type it into chat, we can announce what words they are. Give the viewer a running count. They can kind of guess which part of the tongue it is.
Maybe
it'd be like a pathetic game.
So it is on the left side of my tongue. It's not like the big molars, but it's kind of the medium molars before the canine there. I think is the culprit what did it. And it's bad. I feel pain as I speak, but aww, we soldier on.
I want to give like a meta note that Cole, you've changed your picture in Discord to Banshee after the Deckfest recording.
Yeah,
that's awesome.
I never changed it back is the thing. So
you never needed to.
Yeah. No, but that's what's going on here. Nothing new except for my mouth pain. Let's see, David. I don't believe you were here last time. What's going on?
Not a whole heck of a lot. Did a ton of martial arts over the weekend, but not really anything, you know, that's kind of, you know, much of a story. Just kind of, you know, keeping on at this point.
Yeah. I gotcha. Like, how is New York right now with like the second wave or the resurgence or any of that?
Yeah, it's actually, honestly, it's actually doing pretty well. Okay. Apparently New York is like just about the only place in the country that isn't having, like a second wave.
Oh yeah.
And, nice. Is kind of doing at least a certain degree of like reopening. So it's actually kind of cool. I don't know if it's going to be, if this means it's maybe going to be permanent or not, but the bar in front of my apartment and then one kind of across the street basically built like almost like a patio in the like parking, on street parking area. So like, you know, like this wooden, literally like wooden kind of half wall and mm-hmm. like flooring. And it looks like maybe there's going to be slots for them to like put in like flower beds.
Oh, nice.
So I don't know if like, I think it'd be great if the city just decided like, yeah, that's going to be a thing now. Mm-hmm. But it looks like at the very least, that's going to be part of how they deal with social distancing.
Nice. Cool.
So, yeah.
Well, it's a weird thing to brag about that you're in a safe area of the country, but go ahead, I guess. Oh, geez.
I survived New York.
Yeah. Ben, how about you? How are you doing?
I'm doing pretty good. So I recently had a friend from Austin long term or short to medium term move to Seattle because Texas is apparently not so great right now, coronavirus-wise. But I have a new adventure friend. So I mean, we went to Mount Rainier yesterday and did like a tiny hike, but we got to explore, and that was a lot of fun. I learned about the concept of type 2 fun, which I
had not.
Have you heard about this?
What?
It's where you do something that is not fun at all. It is like very, like, it gives you stress or wears you out, and it's kind of miserable. But in hindsight, after doing it, you've had a fun time. So like a little strenuous hike that gets to like a pretty spot or whatever, something like that.
Yeah.
And so I had not heard of that concept before. So I had a type 2 fun day, I guess. Actually, it wasn't that bad. It was a type 1 fun day. But yeah.
Very cool. I had never heard of that concept. But that is useful.
Yeah, it's kind of a little bit of the what doesn't kill us makes us stronger type of thing.
I've definitely said something along the lines of, I hated doing that, but I'm glad we did it.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I think that, that probably is the wordier way that I would have done that. Nice. Like how is Mount Rainier this time of year, like scenery wise?
Oh, it's super pretty. So like on clear days, if you're traveling south from Seattle, you can see it from like Seattle, basically. So it felt very Journey-esque, where it's like at the beginning of the morning, you see it way off in the distance. And then like maybe like 3 hours later, you're like seeing it very close, very up close and personal. The only way you can get to the actual top is if you like ice climb and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I think you need like permits for that. So we didn't do any of that. But the national park goes to like close to the top of the tree line. I'm not sure what the elevation is, but you can, there's like a nice, like different lakes that you can stop off that you can see it in like the reflection of the lake. There's one called Reflection Lake. So you're like, you're closer to it. It's very evocative of like, playing Breath of the Wild and like going to the top of like a mountain or a volcano there. And it's like very like, peaceful, you know? And yeah.
So do you get above the tree line?
We did not go above the tree line. There might be trails that you can get that high towards. We were like maybe, I don't know, a couple hundred feet short of that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, that sounds pleasant and wholesome.
Yeah. Yeah.
So what sort of, what would be like, what is the biome there? Is this like pine tree land or?
Yeah. So last weekend I had gone to Olympic National Park, which is like west by like the ocean. And like that's more like feels like a quote unquote rainforest where it's like that, I guess that sort of plant life, I guess. This was much more like dark green, like pine tree forest type of thing. Mm-hmm. There's certain points where you get to certain elevations and you can see just like almost like endless valleys that are all just pine trees and that's more of the wildlife. So
yeah. Nice. Mm-hmm. Thank you for sharing that. Dennis, how about you? How are you doing?
Doing good. We this week found out that we are having our third boy. So woohoo. Obviously would have been thrilled either way, but it's fun to find little things to celebrate in these times. So
yeah.
We have boy number three on the way.
Yeah.
And that was the fun reveal this week.
That's like hitting a jackpot on a slot machine, but it doesn't spit out coins. It just means you can give like shoes to a third person.
Yes.
It spits out shoes.
Maybe, I don't know. It kind of the metaphor broke down.
We were going to have to get a new house to hold all the clothing that was going to be purchased if we were having a girl. So
yeah,
this is the better option, at least on that front.
Nice.
But yeah, it's fun times.
Congratulations.
I remember you saying that you like purposely wanted your children to like share rooms with one another. So is there going to be this like weird dance where like the next boy will share one with Milo and then Luke will like upgrade, or are all three of them going to be in the same room?
That's a tricky question.
Okay.
Cause there's a little bit more of a gap between Milo and baby number three than there is between Luke and Milo. So I don't know, like for a time I was in a single room with all three of, or I guess all two of my brothers, there were three of us total.
Yeah.
And I don't know if we would do that or what, but yeah, that's we might have to figure something out just to
Yeah,
you can rotation system, or you know what we'll do is we'll set up like a rating system, and whoever's done the best gets their own room for a given night, and then the other two have to share.
I'm sorry, did you say a rating system or a raiding system?
Dealer's choice.
Yeah. Oh, depends on how bad the day was. It sounds snarky, but this is true parenting story. Is we literally have a day chart for Luke and Milo, and it is like the most effective parenting tool we've ever arrived on.
Yeah,
it's literally just you know, 9 boxes on top of each other, 3 green, 3 yellow, 3 red, and a little magnet, you know, strip along it that we move them on. And like basically there's so many things, especially when you get to their age of like, you know, 6 years old, where they know how to test your patience or kind of push buttons without actually breaking any rules. Mm-hmm. And so it's not appropriate to like punish them or put them in timeout or take something away because they haven't done anything that bad, but they know they're being shitheads. You know, they're being shitheads and need some way to deal with it. And so for us, it's just become, all right, I'm bumping you down on the day chart. Like that was, you know, that wasn't cool. You're going, we're like, hey, you're having a good day. You haven't done anything like big, crazy thing, but you just had a good day. So I'm going to move you up. And that has been hugely motivating for them. And I would say they've been in the red like once a piece since we instituted it months ago.
Yeah. It seems like it would be useful to externalize the authority to a certain extent because it will take them a very long time to realize that the system is entirely fabricated. Now, once they do figure that out, you're going to be dealing with some very, let's say, disaffected children who
that's a good lesson, right?
Do not don't trust believe in
wait
any,
I feel like isn't that just preparing them for life? Like you need to know the rest of your life will revolve around how many likes you get.
You need to understand that is a fake idea. I'm not criticizing your parenting. I just want you to be ready for when that gate comes crashing down.
Oh man, we will cross that bridge when we come to it is the motto of parenting. No,
you just need to read up on some social contract theory, you know.
Also, God, please let Facebook have imploded by the time my children.
Oh yeah,
anything that resembles social media, I want to be dead and gone.
So it's pretty shocking, like how many people I know that have just, well, I guess it's not shocking how many people are like, oh yeah, I'm not doing social media again, but like how many people I know who have actually gone through with it and are like just completely off of social media.
Yeah,
which grant, like if I was a smarter like wiser person, I would totally do that. I'm totally in board with that. I'm just saying.
Well, it's interesting. We were having a conversation before we started here about how, you know, Slack and Discord have kind of become this, you kind of can have your circles there. Like it's digital community where everyone isn't just lumped in on top of each other, which is actually a very healthy thing in many, many situations. So, you know, whatever comes next, it can't be worse.
If you want a defensive strategy, use the South Park method. You and Jen just have to think it's cool and act like it's cool, and they won't want to do
it. Yeah, just really get their engagement up and then push them away.
That's right.
Yeah,
that's right.
I would not I would be very intimidated to have to deal with that. That would be really rough.
You guys, we get a couple years to figure that out at least, huh?
I feel like this conversation got too real. So I'm going to back us away from there real quick. I think that we've got to get started because I have some games to talk about this time, which is unusual for me. So if there's no objection, I say we do a regular kind of show, you know, the grind, the multiplayer, and then the end boss. And we can get started with
the grind.
The grind, where we talk about the games we have been playing over the past period of time or so. David, you've been away the longest, so I will throw to you first.
Yeah, so I've actually got a couple of things I've tried out. I checked out a game on Game Pass called, I think it's West of Dead. So it's a roguelike kind of, I don't know what the term would be, like isometric, is that a thing?
Yeah.
Yeah, so isometric cover shooter.
Okay.
So you That's play as a cowboy who wakes up in the afterlife, which happens to be a rundown saloon, only to find that apparently something is blocking the souls of the departed from passing on.
Okay.
Someone simply referred to as the preacher. And so you have to fight through, the underworld, which is entirely, Western themed, in order to, chase down this person and figure out what's going on. It's got a really neat aesthetic, very dark and, makes big use of, lighting effects. So like a lot of the rooms will have, old kerosene lanterns in them that you have to light in order to be able to see enemies, and that will temporarily stun them, that sort of thing. So it's a big light or dark, mechanic. And then from a gameplay standpoint, the other, big thing is the weapons you have, really emphasizes kind of the different classes of weapons. So you can have revolvers that, usually have about 6 shots and, low damage, but you can pretty much just fire them as soon as you shoot. Whereas rifles, you have to like click and hold and you'll kind of zero in on an enemy.
Okay.
So it's a very tactical style of gameplay.
You're making it sound a little bit like Bastion.
Yeah, well, and that is the other thing is it really leans into a kind of Bastion-inspired narration. Oh. Although this time it's not so much, it's not a narrator, it's your character kind of monologuing to himself.
Okay.
In the spirit of a Western. So like, just as example, the things you collect that are, your ability to upgrade in between runs are, called Sin.
Okay.
And, in between runs, you run into this, a witch, that will, take this in and, give you these upgrades. And, so he'll, monologue about, I wonder from time to time what that witch does with all that sin she's acquired over the years. Now look her in the eye and realize 'twarn't none of my business. just that sort of, that kind of, traditional Western type of thing. So nice. Really good. The gameplay for me, it didn't quite hit it off. I need to try it with a controller, although if I remember correctly, I think it maybe doesn't work with a PlayStation controller, which probably isn't surprising because this is in the like Xbox kind of published wing of things.
So public service announcement, there's software, I think it's called DS4, but I've had the same problem with the PS4 controller where it never worked. But once I used that, I was able to use PS4 controller on computer.
Okay. Yeah, I'll give that a shot. But like even outside the gameplay, like even if that doesn't quite work, I think the, the aesthetics and, kind of the tone and those sorts of things really justify it.
Okay.
The other thing I've been playing, actually, in kind of a similar vein, is Neon Abyss.
Okay.
So this is a side-scrolling shooter, shoot 'em up, bullet hell game that I guess is sort of set in a nominally cyberpunk setting, although a bit more leaning into kind of the 80s, neon synthwave type of thing.
Yeah. much more cartoony than that would lead you to believe.
Yeah. And it really draws heavily in particular on some of the Binding of Isaac DNA in terms of, you know, having a ton of different upgrades that drop and having pretty much all of them affecting the way your avatar looks, often in kind of ridiculous ways.
Cool.
And the other thing that's kind of weird is each of the bosses are sort of like it'll be like such and such the god of social media, or like you know such and such god of influencers. Like they're all sort of, I don't know, themed after these kind of Black Mirror-esque like social ills. Okay. I guess you could say. Although the game doesn't seem to have any sort of, like, there is no coherent plot line whatsoever. It is not going anywhere with anything. Not that that's a bad thing. Mm-hmm. It just is.
Yeah.
Although my biggest complaint with it probably is apparently, you know, each of the characters has a special move. And, like, there's eventually one of them that their special move is the ability to do a dodge roll. But ultimately, I think in a bullet hell game and definitely in a roguelike game, I just don't think you can really have the game work without a dodge mechanic. You know, it just ends up not being enough verbs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So yeah, it'll be interesting to see where it goes. I think it's early access, so I'm hoping, you know, maybe they change some of that stuff up. But yeah, you know, at the very least, it seems like an enjoyable enough game.
Mm-hmm. Hmm. Nice.
And then the last thing I picked up is actually a game that is on sale called Volcanoids.
Hmm. Yeah, no, you're 3 for 3 on games I never heard about.
Yeah, it's been kind of a weird week. So this one is, I guess, sort of in the Subnautica / No Man's Sky / Satisfactory vibe, in that it takes place in this steampunk setting where you know, this island or archipelago or something, you know, people were living there, and then someday like all these volcanoes start erupting and robots appear out of the ground driving these vehicles that are basically like giant drills that just burrow through the ground.
It's like the Underminer from The Incredibles.
Yes, exactly. And then, you know, you kind of fast forward, I don't know, a couple years, and you're part of a team that's, you know, coming back to, you know, reclaim the area, and you basically take over one of these machines, and that becomes your home base that you then have to, you know, basically scavenge, robot technology and build it into your base to convert into your vehicle to slowly convert it to kind of this moving factory / you know, transportation. It's got kind of a unique mechanic in that I think by default it's like 30 minutes on normal mode, the volcanoes erupt, and so you have to get back to your vehicle and burrow underground before that happens, or you just automatically die.
Okay. It's just a more codified version of what happens in Minecraft at night.
Yes, exactly. That's also how they get around, like, that's when all of the resources respawn and, you know, that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. But it ends up, I'm only a couple hours into it, but, you know, it is very much a janky game. Like, it is very clearly not made by a team that English is their first language.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's kind of seems like it's going to end up being the kind of Eurojank thing where, you know, they're, was it their grasp is longer than their reach, or maybe have that backwards?
Yeah.
But at the same time, at least for me, I think that's something where, like, I'm okay with that as long as you're trying interesting things.
Mm-hmm.
So one element,
and you don't permanently corrupt my save.
Right, exactly.
Yes, yeah.
One element that of it that I do actually really like is it's much more claustrophobic than most games of this style. So your vehicle is much more like a, say, like World War II era tank, where you're just kind of, you know, stuffing in, you know, hydraulics and, you know, workbenches and things like that. And, like, you know, your bed that you use to heal is, you know, right next to the boiler, which is across from, I don't know, your periscope or whatever. So it definitely has a very unique feel that I think works at its advantage.
Mm-hmm.
I'll need to play more to see kind of where it goes with this storyline, though.
Yeah. No, I had never heard of this before, and it's good to know that there's kind of, like, you know, something else out there for when, you know, possibly when, oh gosh, Subnautica kind of runs out of steam.
Yeah, yeah. And in this case...
Specifically, replacing that with steampunk.
Oh, yeah. Exactly.
Didn't do that intentionally, but yeah.
Yeah. I would be interested here as a side note, what would be, because I think you guys are kind of more in on the pulse of this. What would be the big game for kind of the vehicle / crafting sim subgenre or whatever you want to call it?
That's not Subnautica.
Yeah,
Motherload, way back in the browser games in high school days.
Factorio, probably, or it needs to be 3D. Is that a condition?
No, whatever works.
Yeah,
Factorio, probably.
Yeah, my reference point would be Subnautica. So, for the exploration, survival, crafting kind of thing.
Yeah, because I'm really zeroing in on I love Subnautica. I really enjoy No Man's Sky.
Have you not played Factorio yet?
I have not.
The main differentiating point is there's the combat's like not, you just shoot things, it dies or whatever. It's not like that complicated, but the crafting and how you craft is very much more complicated because you're making like a giant like Lego set of everything working together. So, and it's kind of like Satisfactory where you're controlling conveyor belts a lot, mm-hmm. but it seems like it's more complicated even than that. So
the ceiling for complexity is way higher in Factorio.
Yeah.
Nice. All right. Yeah, I'll definitely check that out. Yeah, because I'm trying to get into that, kind of exploring some alternatives, trying to find some games that are, not quite as depressing as, the world we find ourselves in.
Yeah.
Spoiler alert, you are, like, pillaging a planet full of resources and killing the indigenous life on it in Factorio. So as long as you're okay with that.
I don't know. To be fair, in 2020, the indigenous life has been trying pretty hard to kill me. So,
Yeah. Oh, geez.
Yeah. No, I was talking with someone, like, I really want to play, was it Carrion? But that's just not the tone I'm up for right now.
I got you, bud. I'll be talking about Carrion later on tonight.
So. Yeah.
Nice. So West of Dead, Neon Abyss, and Vulcanoids. I got to say, you were ahead of all of us on the Game Pass thing. Microsoft's event last week, just basically where they said, oh, yeah, and all of this is going to be on Game Pass, was a really good sales drop pitch for this. Yeah.
Yeah.
I read and forgive me, I never know, most of my gaming news I find through like the programming enthusiasts. So I never know if something's like, something that maybe people that are into video games have been talking about for months. And I'm just hearing about it. But I read a really interesting article basically making the argument that you know, the kind of the meta story for this console fight or for this console iteration is like, Sony is trying its best to win the console war, and Microsoft is realizing that it doesn't care.
Yeah. Yeah. Microsoft has a huge opportunity to kind of like lean into the PC side of things. And
yeah,
with Nintendo saying, no, we don't need to have the best console because our console is also the best portable. Like, Sony is kind of left holding the bag being the pure game system right now, when there are good cases to be made for Microsoft and Nintendo's approaches being much more attractive right now.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Nice. So yeah, suffice to say, I'm very curious about looking into Game Pass at this point.
Yeah.
Yeah. Do you guys mind if I go?
Sounds like we had a segue for it. Yeah.
Yeah. So David said he is not in the mood for carrion right now. I am. So I have been, you know, I think I'm about like a third of the way through it, probably.
Nice.
Carrion is like a 2D Metroidvania style game where you play as the big amorphous monster who is rampaging through a lab and killing people and assimilating their biomass and mutating and growing, etc. and down the line. This was an early standout, a couple of years ago, maybe even just like last year at like a Devolver or PC game show kind of thing. Whatever event I first saw it at. And, I gotta say, it is not disappointing me. It is very, very satisfying to be this monster, even if it isn't like the most empowering thing all of the time, which is very, like a pleasant surprise that you really do have to lean into, you know, stealthiness and almost like a Hotline Miami style, order of operations when you approach a room, you know, full of, you know, civilians, whatever, you can just, you know, take care of them. But like the people, like the actual guards and soldiers that you oftentimes are going to be mowing down, they have like assault rifles and they have energy shields that will hurt you. And like very cannily, a lot of the screens that you have, you know, that you go to have like vents and doors and stuff around. So
ain't that convenient.
Yeah, well, vents and doors, a thing most buildings don't have.
I have to say, I don't know if it's considered a thing, but Hotline Miami stealth is a very apt way to describe the type of stealth game where you don't actually have to be stealthy. You just need to make sure everyone is dead within 0.3 seconds of seeing you.
Right. Oh, yeah.
No,
yeah.
That is my favorite type of stealth.
Yeah, first mover advantage stealth, like that happens a lot in like Far Cry games, or like that's a thing in you know, like Batman Arkham games as well, right?
Probably my favorite game with that is actually Max Payne 2.
Oh yeah,
really leans into that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we made that when we covered. Oh God, when we covered the original Max Payne seven years ago at this point, we also kind of called out like the comparison between those. Like every individual room is its own little puzzle challenge to take people out.
Not to digress, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. No, it just it's an actual thing in games, and it is here in force in a really entertaining way. Something that's kind of neat, right now I am only at like the second level of organism growth or whatever, but you know, as you go, you get new abilities by knocking over radiation canisters and crawling inside of them, to get new abilities or whatever. And there's almost like, tiers of health, that represent the amount of biomass that you have available to you. And there are different powers that are available, when you're at, you know, let's say 1 to 5 health than if you were at 5 to 10 health, if that makes any sense.
Yeah.
Okay.
Or 1 to 5 and 6 to 10 rather. And it's not always, you know, to your advantage to be as big as possible. So like if you are massive, one of your attack options is to do like almost like a full body tackle that will burst through different barriers and will also like knock people over, stuff like that. But you cannot do the web shoot kind of thing that you can do when you're smaller. So like there are some places where you need to be able to, you know, kind of like reach through a very fine grating. You need to be smaller in order to make that shot. So oftentimes, you know, certain areas you will have to discard your biomass in a pool, which is super gross as a sentence. I'm sorry that I said it. This is my official apology for saying discarding biomass in a pool. but you're more vulnerable when this happens, and you want to like accomplish what you can accomplish or what you need to accomplish with the web shot, navigate that without dying, so you can get back to the biomass that you discarded to, you know, get big again for like more direct combat. So
it's not a permanent loss,
right?
And it's like persistent. Like if you somehow lose that is there any way to lose, or you just always come back to it and get it back again?
You don't always have to come back to it. If you leave that behind, you can just, you can recoup the loss, the old fashioned way, just by munching on some folks.
Yeah.
Like you do. Okay.
Yeah.
I like the idea that there could be pool cleaners around that are going to,
you're making their life hell
for so long. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm just kind of disturbed. I'm hearing a lot of just, you know, throwing your biomass all over, shooting it on people.
It's called carrion. What were we expecting?
It's going to be goopy.
What Steam tags does this game have?
I don't know. I'm playing it on Switch. And it's a good fit there, actually. Go ahead.
I was going to say, I've watched a couple of videos of this. It seems like, I was struck by, it seems like the game handles very quickly, and also like it almost maybe has some like video gamey grappling hook type of movement you're doing. Is that accurate?
Yeah, to a certain extent. So your main attack that you always have access to, at least, you know, so far in the game, is to kind of extend your kind of main tendril and grab onto things. And that operates a little bit like a grappling hook. Like you can grab onto physics items and swing them around. That is not how you move, actually. Movement is kind of handled automatically. It's almost like gravity doesn't apply to you. You just press to move in a direction and the monster's tendrils will like automatically reach out and pull you in that direction. So it moves very quickly. What you're seeing when you see like the cursor pop up is somebody like reaching out and selecting and trying to, you know, hover over the thing they want to grab so they can throw it or bring it back to the maw.
Okay.
Yeah. But it rules. Like, I'm not going to say this is the most meaningful video game experience. Like, I don't know, maybe they can surprise me, but like as a fun, kind of mayhem simulator, you know, it's a little bit like, I think this is a worse game, but I kind of have a similar feeling. The original Prototype, the first Prototype game where you're kind of playing as, basically you're playing as Venom. There's a certain amount of playing as Venom here that is deliciously fun, and like the enemies will panic when you like certain enemies will panic, and like some of them will be brave depending on what type they are. But yes, you know, cower before me, you puny humans.
But actually, hold on a second, you gotta dump some biomass in the pool, be right back. Pretend I'm here, cower anyway.
Yeah. But yeah, it's like, it's super cool and kind of just like the nice, like lighthearted thing that I want, you know, for certain definitions of lighthearted.
As in you take hearts out of people.
Yes. You lighten their hearts.
Yeah.
Also, I mean, like there is really no text or dialogue in this. Like the one time that the game slows down is at certain points you like, I don't know if these are flashbacks or if they're your monster is like going into a particular room and doing like a remote viewing thing. You do sometimes control humans and you get a real sense of how limited their kind of their skill sets and movements are. And it's a real bummer as you navigate these things, but like it has the kind of like secondary effect, or maybe this is intentional, but when you're back controlling the monster, the speed and ferocity with which you can accomplish things that were very difficult as a human, is, you know, a joy again, you know, to get back to it, which is nice.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's cool. Yeah, there's no text to this. There's no dialogue. Like nobody says, like really the only like exposition that is there is like there are occasionally like LED message boards that like are like warning signs, or we'll talk about like how many like containment seals are breached, like just basically like providing a little bit of information about the area. It's kind of like the Oddworld games had similar kind of things, you know, like level summaries presented on LED boards like that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Any questions about Carrion?
No, sweet. Sounds like fun.
Yeah.
Yeah. So my next two things, it's going to be pretty short, actually, or at least one of them. I want to sing its praises. Are you guys familiar with the mobile game developer Zach Gage?
No.
Oh, that sounds familiar.
Yeah, he did Spell Tower initially. He also did Pocket Run Pool. He did very good Solitaire. He did pretty bad Chess, I believe.
Oh, he did, it looks like Card of Darkness, which yes. was a fun game.
Yeah, that was an Apple Arcade kind of launch game, killer app kind of thing. I never thought it would be possible, but Zach Gage got me interested in Sudoku games. Zach Gage put out a game called Good Sudoku, which is a collaboration between
the shadiest throwing name,
which is a collaboration between him and a programmer, Jack Schlesinger. I want to make sure, you know, it's a small team. You can credit everybody. but their idea was like they were interested in Sudoku as a puzzle. They understood, you know, like, yeah, this is popular. There's joy to be had here, but there's just so much busy work inherent to solving a Sudoku, you know, marking off your possibles and, you know, identifying that like, okay, this number was used here. Just a lot of things that you do manually. All of that is automated in this. So the act of solving the Sudoku is right. Like it gets right down to what number should go where. It lets you know, like, yeah, a 7 will not go here because it's already in this row, column, or house, like down to that. And in addition to that, it also like has the best Sudoku tutorial that I've seen, where it will like straight up describe in very good terms that get through to me, what particular techniques are when you would use them and how they work.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah. I mean, it's free, you know, to get. I think it comes with, you know, just like you get a couple of different difficulty levels. It, like even to just buy the full game, it's only $3. So I don't know, toss a coin to your boy. but like Good Sudoku has like helped me bridge the gap because I figured I'd be a Picross guy for life. But like I'm having fun like solving Sudokus real quick because all of the friction is taken away.
It sounds like it's less Good Sudoku and more Good Tutorial.
Possibly. Yeah. In one sense, I'm probably ruined for Sudoku because going and playing any other app, without the quality of life enhancements, here would be difficult and irritating, but, I am fine. I am fine going through this and understanding what some of the like high level techniques are and stuff for a Sudoku.
Have you learned the lesson that a Sudoku puzzle has to be unique? So if there's ever a situation where you have like four boxes where the two different numbers can go either way in them, then you're at a wrong solution. So you have to go back.
No, I've not.
That's the most advanced Sudoku lesson I know.
That seems pretty advanced. That's like a meta puzzle almost.
Yeah.
Yeah. But Good Sudoku. Any questions about that?
I'm happy that you're enjoying Sudoku.
Yeah. The final thing is one that I streamed, and you can go and, you know, take a look at that if you are curious about a more in-depth discussion. But I streamed a game over the weekend called Bendy and the Ink Machine.
Oh, how is that?
I didn't like it.
Yeah, it looked.
So, like, the style of it is really cool. So this is, you know, a pretty common type of, you know, first person exploration horror game that is really specifically, I think, designed with, you know, either streamers or people who like to watch horror game streamers in mind, specifically like, you know, streamer kind of folks. The idea is that, like, you have gotten this letter from an old friend. You both used to work at this animation studio. He was the owner. You are, like, the head, you know, you used to be the head animator. You left and you come back and everything has gone wrong because he has made what amounts to a machine for pigs. I called it Bendy and the Oink Machine.
Great pun, by the way.
Thank you. It was good enough that I had to repeat it. I don't feel great about it, but it needed to, and I feel like it was necessary. but no, like, they're doing, like, dark science related to this magical ink that is bringing unwholesome life to these horrible monstrosities that are kind of based on the characters, of the studio. Has a very strong art style. You know, it is monochrome. It's like, you know, like a sepia and black, as opposed to being like black and white. It's a little bit like a Psychonauts level is the comparison that came up a few times. Mm-hmm. Like, stylistically, I don't have an awful lot of problems with it. It's just from a gameplay perspective where, For lack of a better thing to have you do, as they work up a sense of dread and as they, you know, try and put you in positions where jump scares can happen to you, most of the time this falls back on what a lot of these games fall back on, which is like scavenger hunt kind of things. Like, this gate won't open, so go back through this big level you just went through and get these four items or destroy six of these, et cetera, et cetera. And it grows very thin. Add into that some very bad signaling for particular puzzles and for particular, like, you know, boss fights and encounters and stuff like that. And just an awful lot of what I felt was unnecessary and untoward frustration. That ultimately left me just, like, you know, at beyond a certain point, like, I would have just dropped this game if I was not streaming it, but because I was streaming it, I felt like I needed to give it a shot. Mm-hmm. it just, fell into a bunch of, like, traps, you know, that, like, I think were not established, but probably, like, codified, like, in the first, you know, like, Slender Man game that made it big, you know, Slender the Arrival, where you're just like wandering around the woods trying to find eight pages. It's like that, but repeated ad nauseum here.
Any quest with a number easily inserted into it is is probably not the best.
Yeah.
Unless it's Sudoku.
And then the numbers are the quest. Yeah.
So what is the horror to it? Like, that's what I've never been able to understand is, like, what actually...
It taps into the genre of ink horror.
Yeah. so the horror is that there's just a machine that is pumping out, both pumping out monsters. They are deformed and they're coming after you. There's a demon, like an ink demon, who is chasing after you a lot. So it's like amnesia to a certain extent where you've got to hide when it comes after you. Like, from a subject matter perspective, like, they're taking people and running them through the ink machine and, you know, turning them into, you know, cartoon monster kind of things.
So are these, like, so you are a three-dimensional person, correct? Are these, yes, like, two-dimensional things?
No, they're three-dimensional, but, you know, they are uncanny in the way that a two-dimensionally designed character would look weird if it was brought into 3D at that level of cartooniness.
Yeah, it looks, okay. I mean, from what I'm seeing, for the most part, like, someone took Cuphead and made it 3D, but then, yeah, it looks like some of the ink monster things are kind of very realistic in the way the ink moves, etc.
Yeah. Cuphead is a common point of comparison. Cuphead is far more impressive because that is hand done 2D animation. Mm. And 3D animation is just like a different thing that is kind of a more common skill set these days.
Makes sense.
Yep. So I didn't care for it. You can't win everything. You know, they're not all going to be great.
Two out of three is not bad.
Nope.
Yeah. This looks like a game. Does this have the the Five Nights at Freddy's thing where there's some sort of storyline that's definitely in the game, but only if you read all the obscure whatchamandingos?
Yeah, most of those are through audio logs that are pretty hard to find. There were a couple of people who were very versed in the game who, I do not understand this mode of watching streams, but there are people who do it, and God bless them, where they just have an alert set for whenever somebody starts streaming a game they like. Like, they came in and started, backseat driving or pointing out things that I missed, etc., asking leading questions and stuff. And I was like, hey, guys, kind of cool it, please. that stuff is there. There are things that are easily missed that will kind of flesh things out. Again, I think that it is following in the Five Nights at Freddy's mold in that way. Additionally, people who watch who have kids or are around kids say that, this is totally, this teenager in my life or this tween in my life loves all these games that YouTubers scream at, Bendy and the Ink Machine, Five Nights at Freddy's, etc. Down the line. So I had no idea I was getting into that when I fired up the game.
Sad it couldn't have been something better, but
yeah, whatever.
Interesting. An interesting failure is worth talking about.
I stream anywhere between 15 and 20 games a year. Not all of them could be winners. It's fine.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Let's see, Dennis, I want to hear about you. What you've been up to, what you've been playing.
Yeah. So, I mentioned that I got to watch Mario X Rabbids, last week. And this time I've gotten my hands on it and gotten to play it myself a bit.
Okay.
So I'm on this weird track where, I'll watch Jen playing, and she's doing all the hyper advanced stuff and has upgraded characters and everything like that. And then I'm here in the kiddie mobile version where all the training wheels are still on. But I'm really enjoying the unique stuff that the game has to offer. So this, turn-based, Mario game, which is two great tastes for me anyway, that seem to work pretty well together. The way they vary up the objectives has been cool so far. So there's missions where you have to kill all the enemies. Or I don't know what they call it, defrag them or something. They get little blue swirlies around them and evaporate into the air.
Mm-hmm. So they are totally not dying.
Totally not dying, yes.
Yeah.
But then there are also missions where your goal is to just get to an area. And you only have to get one character there. And then they just put a whole bunch of enemies in your way such that, there's more spawning every turn. And you can't feasibly, kill your way there, for lack of a better term. It feels weird to say that in a Mario game, but you have to kind of creatively use the movement abilities in this game, which are very interesting, and then kind of pick your spots to clear the path and pick your spots to try to run away from people to get there successfully. And I found those to be really, really enjoyable and my favorite missions that I've encountered so far.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of that plus the movement powers where, if you are standing close enough to an ally, you can use them as a springboard.
Almost exactly like in the new Super Mario Brothers games.
Yeah. It's like they took inspiration from it. if you plan your turn right, you can effectively double your motion range. Which is fantastic without any trade-offs. I'm so used to in these games that you can either sprint or you can move a normal amount and do something. Mm-hmm. And here you can have it all, baby. You just got to plan well enough, which is great. And it's very, very rewarding to play that out. And it creates these great moments where it's like, oh, one square over, I could be in cover. but one square back and my teammates can use me as a springboard. Like which do I choose? Do I take the damage to get the better positioning and, you know, all that kind of stuff. So that's really fun. The world too, like, you know, Mario worlds are always very filled with just delight and joy and little surprises. Like that's, that's what the game does really well. And they've crossed it up with Rabbids, which just adds this element of, slapstick and amuckness to it.
Okay.
So Rabbids is basically like Minions for people who are only mostly awful.
Yes. And you know, the idea is that those two worlds have been merged together in all these interesting ways. And as you're walking between levels, that is showcased everywhere, but you can't really see it. And that's because for most of the game, when you're exploring between the tactical levels, your camera is at a fixed isometric view and you can rotate it, which is good, thank God, but you cannot take it off of that 45 degrees downward view, which means that if you're standing on the very edge of something, wanting to look at something that's off in the background, which again, they've filled this game with so much love and delight and all these little moments. You have to like work and like, you know, figure out the right corner to be in and then turn the camera the perfect way to see it out of the corner of your eye. And it's just painful.
That's frustrating.
Yeah. And like, you know, I've played Breath of the Wild on this thing. I know that the you can show everything and there's no real gameplay reason that I can see for locking the camera. Oh, go ahead.
I can't see a reason for not having an option to do a free look kind of thing. I could see if they're aiming it at people who might not, you know, necessarily be the most adept at navigating a 3D camera. Like if this is, you know, what it is marketed as, which is kind of an entry level strategy game, why they would want to make it so that you couldn't lose sight of the tactically necessary information, let's say.
The level is presented a certain way and the camera jives with that, which I like that rationale would make sense, but it has been as frustrating at times in the game as it has in the explore mode. So it's an odd choice. It's like, my first thought was like, oh, they're, you know, trying to save computing power, but there's no reason they should have to do that with what they're showing. Mm. So instead of being able to wander around between levels and kind of enjoy all this stuff that's been put into the game, there are a couple places where you can hit A to get like a special zoomed in camera on it, on, you know, a particular highlight. Mm-hmm. But otherwise you're kind of just at the mercy of whatever happens to be close enough.
Yeah.
So that's disappointing. But it is also, you know, that is the ability to wander around between tactical levels is something I really like.
Yeah.
So it is so weird that this is the game that has done Mario without jump.
I mean, that and Captain Toad Treasure Tracker, which is a Mario game where you cannot jump.
Interesting.
And you don't play as Mario, you play as a Toad, but.
Yeah. Which one came out first? I guess Treasure Tracker.
Which is ironic because, you know, Toads traditionally known for their jumping ability.
Well, I mean, like these are mushrooms. I've not seen mushrooms jump very often.
You haven't been using the right mushrooms.
You haven't been eating the right mushrooms.
Man, we all jumped on that one.
Yeah. Captain Toad, I believe, came out before because that was a Wii U game.
Yeah,
it was a like a bonus mode in Super Mario 3D World before that.
Yeah. So anyway, this game, you know, between the tactical levels where you're literally moving on a grid, you can run around with Mario just like you would in any other game, sans the jump button. And you can actually run back through the levels that you just did. You can run and kind of explore secret areas between. Mm-hmm. And that creates this really nice just kind of flow to the game of exploration and then tactical combat and back and forth. Whereas, you know, an XCOM or the like usually has some kind of like macro strategy layer and then the tactical level and then macro strategy. This is I would call it a platforming layer, except there's no jumping
and
really no platforming then.
Yeah.
But an exploration mode in between levels. And I like that because you can almost, you can see the tactical lair as it comes up. They always have like two flags on either side of the entrance, so you know when you're walking into it. And you can kind of look at the structures ahead, which feel like the rest of the game would be like, oh, this is going to be interesting. Or like, yep, that tower is going to be full of enemies or, you know, whatever, as you're walking into it, which is really fun. Yeah. So that's, like I said, I'm still fairly at the stage with training wheels on, but it's fun in the kind of twists that it has thrown in via movement and objectives have been nice. And then I've seen that the game gets hella hard in later levels. So that's been fun as well.
Nice. Yeah, no, it's neat to hear you talk about like the fact that you are finding interesting trade-offs specifically with like action and movement order and, you know, kind of weighing cover against mobility and stuff like that. Like that actually is pretty comforting to me, like from you as somebody who really is, you know, is not just neck deep in XCOM, but ears deep, eyebrows deep, however deep you want to go, that there is still like interesting stuff happening here tactically.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's, I think, especially when you reduce the scope, like it's like Into the Breach in that, you know, a reduced scope means that the, what is done is more bespoke and intense.
Yeah.
And I'm happily, you know, I'm happy with that trade-off in this case.
Mm-hmm.
The other game I've been playing is a real-time strategy game that I mentioned a couple weeks ago, Homeworld.
The
remaster game I went back to. So not as much time in that as Mario and Rabbids this week. Mm-hmm. I keep on wanting to say Mario X Rabbids, but I think it's Mario plus Rabbids.
Yeah.
So Mario and Rabbids. So Homeworld is, God, a 15-year-old plus game at this point.
More than that. Like that was... like a really impressive, like, I mean, like this is back in the day of like voodoo graphics cards. So like,
oh wow,
yeah, like that was around the time of like Quake 3 Arena when it first hit. So this would have been like 1999, 2000, something like that. Yeah. So this is like a 20-year-old game at the least.
Yeah, I mean, I played it in grade school, so that is that all checks out.
September 1999. Yeah.
Whoo! Yes. And so, you know, coming back to it, I only played a little bit of it when I was in grade school because it was one of those games you got out from the library and then had to return.
Mm-hmm.
It didn't really run on my machine, or I should say my machine wasn't really powerful enough to run it.
Mm-hmm.
So I just got a taste of it, but it's always stuck in my mind as like that seemed like a really interesting game.
Mm-hmm.
And the answer is yes and no as I've come back to it.
Okay.
So there are moments of striking beauty in this game. Like as a space RTS, it just the moments where I could just sit and watch my ships doing their thing, like fish in an aquarium.
Mm-hmm.
Like take any moment from the game, and it could be like that.
Yeah,
and it's just it's almost like I'm mad when bad guys start attacking because I was having so much fun just watching. Like it is really really beautiful. And serene in that way. Mm-hmm. You know, nothing really makes sound as you move. It all just kind of floats through space, which is apropos. The trade-off there is that space is very empty.
Mm.
And there's not a lot going on. And that is definitely the case in the levels. So, you know, every level that I've been in so far, which granted is four. So this could change.
Mm-hmm.
But is functionally just an empty area, and there's some asteroids sprinkled in one place just so your resource collectors have something to do.
Right.
There's not different kinds of resources. There's not, like, beyond that asteroid field, there's not really points of interest.
Mm-hmm.
And do you still call it a skybox if you're in space?
Yeah. I mean, I think we would all understand what you mean when you say
that.
Just call
it the box.
Yeah. The universe box is gorgeous to look at. But there's like, other than that, there is nothing. There is, and that gets old really quickly. So I think probably, you know, young me was more forgiving of that and just impressed that you could be in space. And older me is like, okay, well, you know, what is there going on here?
Yeah. Like, I mean, in any other real-time strategy game, the map kind of defines your strategic possibilities, yes. Right?
Yes. And that is, you know, every conflict once it's started is functionally the same.
Hmm.
You know, I use my fighters to kind of swarm and be evasive while kind of keeping their fighters at bay. I use my corvettes to, you know, be the main hunters and take out priority targets. And then I use the frigates to make sure anything bigger doesn't get out of control.
Mm-hmm.
The interesting wrinkle that I've seen here, and I know there are characters like this in other RTS games, but is the salvage corvettes, which you can send a couple of them to an enemy frigate and they will like hijack it and pull it back to the mothership and convert it to your unit, which, you know, the conceit of this game is that you are a single fleet of spaceships trying to find your homeworld after the planet that you thought was home was destroyed.
Okay.
And that's, you know, that's a really interesting conceit. And just, I think probably part of the reason the game stuck with me was the story hook was so intriguing. It's like, all right, you know, it's not Earth, but, you know, Earth is not where we came from. It's actually somewhere out there. And in our first attempt at like getting ready for hyperspace travel to go there,
mm-hmm.
We screwed something up so bad that bad guys came out and destroyed Earth. And so our only option is onward.
No.
Like a really cool conceit. And so it is, you know, a single ship means a lot,
mm-hmm.
because you are not just this endless well of stuff. You're you know, kind of the very small.
You're constrained.
You are, yes, in many ways. So that's cool, and it kind of has these fun moments where it takes two salvage ships to actually move a frigate.
Okay.
You can latch on with one.
but all that does is make you very vulnerable.
Yes. Well, what's funny is, so I sent two salvage ships to take a frigate, and then one got picked off. And the other one, the frigate had been disabled, but the one salvage ship couldn't move it anymore. And it reminded me of, like, if you've ever put like a clasp on a kitten's neck and they just kind of shut down.
No.
Yeah, like a clothespin. There's the word.
Oh yeah, no, it's like the instinct where if you grab them by the scruff, like that's what their mom, that's how their moms move them, so they go limp.
Exactly.
Yeah.
They just kind of hit pause, and that's what I had there. Was my salvage Corvette was just this little clothespin on the neck of this frigate.
I'm sorry, I went AFK for a second. Are we talking about Carrion again?
No, still homeworld.
Anyway, yeah, so like there's moments of fun there, but I just don't see where the combat can evolve from that.
Yeah.
Like, especially because it's all in an open space, which is thematic, and that is the idea of the
game. That's what it is. Yeah.
True to the setting, but not necessarily the most fun or interesting.
Maybe so. As the difficulty goes up, because you're still, you know, fairly early on, based on what I'm looking at right here. You know, based on being in four missions in, maybe as the difficulty goes up, the complexity will go up and you will have to compensate for things that make up for not needing to take terrain into account.
Yeah. I won't be surprised at all if it goes there, but that again stands in the way of how much I've enjoyed this as an aquarium.
Mm-hmm.
So I kind of just want a sandbox mode where, you know, give me homeworld, but like a very, complicated like space mining operation management where I'm trying to pull in a bunch of different resources.
Yeah.
Maybe not going to combat.
Oh,
just
so you went to play Eve Online.
Yeah.
Is that what I just invented? That's probably what
I think you just invented Eve.
See you guys in a decade.
Okay.
I feel like, or alternately, someone needs to invent like clicker spacers or something.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, that's that would be fantastic. And, you know, so I've gotten my enjoyment out of Homeworld on that front alone.
Nice. That is the thing that I remember most, is being entranced by how slow everything was. You know, which is, I meant that as a compliment, but it came out sounding like I was like low-key burning it, which is not my intention.
I would go to, it's got an appropriate sense of scale.
Yeah.
In that, like, your ships are booking it. And, mm-hmm. and in particular, I never felt like I was so out of position that it took me long to get into position. Mm-hmm. But it does feel like, oh, it is traversing, you know, wide swaths of space. So yeah. I get that.
Mm-hmm. It is, every other, like, space or sci-fi game had been really fast-paced up to that point for me, in my experience. Mm. And this was different and new and was beautiful and had amazing sci-fi music to it as well. I'm like, again, that is the overriding memory that I have of Homeworld.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I am playing the remastered version. And so it's worth mentioning that I do like the way they've updated it. You can still tell it's an old game, but, mm-hmm. but everything looks great. And again, the game in general just looked great before. Mm-hmm. The updates, I think, have been a service to it. It does highlight that you're either zoomed in enough for the game to be beautiful or zoomed out enough to play it. And it's hard to find the in-between. Like in most, combats, I was zoomed out enough that I was really navigating by the icons around each ship versus by the ships. There is something very cool about that, in that you really do feel like you're presiding over a space battle. But man, I want to see these pretty ships flying around. Mm-hmm. There isn't really a place for that in the fray of things.
Yeah.
Which again points to why I like the aquarium moments so much.
Nice.
And that's Homeworld.
Cool. I'll be curious to hear if they up the complexity.
Yeah. Wow. Well, I've got Homeworld 2 in this purchase. So.
Oh, yeah.
For this to sustain two games, there has to be more to it. And I trust there is. But yeah, it's an interesting little game.
Nice. You have anything else?
No, those are my games.
Cool. Ben, how about you?
Just got one. I want to talk more about Ghost of Tsushima.
Cool.
I've continued playing that for the last week. It's gotten a lot better, so that's good.
Cool.
I think shortly after talking about it last week, I started playing it, and then I got to the title screen of the game, and I was like, oh, okay.
Oh, okay.
I guess it's a couple hours in. Like, okay, maybe, I don't know. So it kind of changed directions at that point. It was more of like an open world game. It's pretty much straight up like a Far Cry game in a sense, except the best version of it. And the story is like so much more rich, and like the gameplay is like so much more tied to the theme of the game than like a typical Far Cry game would be.
Nice.
So basically it's open world. There are missions you can go to, but there's a lot of secondary missions. There's a lot of verbs you can do in the game. There's a lot of things to explore. There's a fun amount of like mini games that they've like put in the games, or like these tiny mechanics in the game. So just to speak of some of them, there's a mini game where you can chop through bamboo, and it's kind of like DDR. You have to press buttons really quickly in order to do it.
Okay.
And it does it in ascending order. So it's like, here's three buttons to press. And then after that, okay, here's five buttons to press, but you basically have to do this within like 2 seconds in order to chop through each one. And if like you miss the pattern, it'll like stop.
What do you gain by chopping through all that bamboo? Are you getting enough to like make some nice flooring, or?
Yeah. So there's only like, this like mini game is only in certain parts of the map if you find it. And if you complete like the set of like mini games, then you, I think it upgrades your focus, I believe. But there's like a lot of things like this in the world. They have like what the equivalent of like a tower or a mountain is, which are shrines that you can go to the top to and pray at. And then you get you unlock a certain it's it, there's these like charms, I think, that give you like certain types of buffs that are kind of all over the place. But you can choose like three or four of them at a time, depending upon how many shrines you go to.
Okay.
To kind of enhance different stats. There's hot springs you can find that increase your maximum health. You can play a flute at any time if you swipe to the left on your gamepad. There's just like a lot of like really fun details in the game, or there's just a lot of like fun things to do that all kind of reinforce the theme of the game, mm-hmm. Reinforce the setting of the game rather.
Is this Rockstar style where it's cool that it's all in there, but the second time you're asked to do it 6 hours later and you don't remember any of it, you're going to be cursing the fact that it's so complex?
No, it's that part hasn't gotten there yet. The mini games are simple enough, and they actually continue. They do the opposite, where they continually tell you what to do in case you have forgotten.
Oh, that's good.
There's one mechanic that's interesting where whenever you see a person, this is kind of ties into the story. So you're a samurai. One of the characters you meet teaches you how to do like stealth kills and stuff. And there's like a character inner conflict where the way of the samurai is you're not supposed to like stab people from the shadows. You're supposed to look them in the eye as you fight them and like challenge them or whatever. So the game allows you to do either option where it's like when you see a person, if you press up on the D-pad, you can challenge them. And it gives you this like quick time event where you hold down triangle and then the character, when they try and swing at you, you can release it and you like in a dramatic motion, you slice them and kill them like a one shot kill. They complicate it later in the game where the person attacking you will do like little psych outs, you know, or like little flourishes where like, you know, and if you like, if you miss let go of the triangle button, then they just get like a free hit on you.
Nice.
And so you start the battle like with a little bit of health down.
Yeah.
On top of this, there's like different stances that you can have when you're swinging with your sword, like one where you're holding the sword over your head or like down, and those are effective against different enemy types. And so you can kind of switch those on the fly quickly by holding R2 and pressing one of the X, square, triangle, circle buttons. And then each of the way they do like an upgrade system, it's kind of interesting, is you have a couple different economies. But then you can kind of spend them in a bunch of different places. So, as similar to a lot of games, there's like a lot of pickups throughout the world to try and, you know, make it feel fleshed out where it's like, you can pick up supplies or iron or steel or whatever. And then from that, you can choose like what sort of thing you want to upgrade. You can upgrade like your weapons with that. You can upgrade your bows. You can upgrade your armor with that. But they all kind of go to the same place with those.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have a generic like XP, like legend, I think is what they call it, type economy, where you basically get that for completing missions. And as you do that, there's a lot of different places you can invest it. You can either unlock like new abilities, like so you can have like a smoke bomb versus a grenade type thing, or you can upgrade like the stances that you have, like what attacks you can unlock with those.
Mm-hmm.
I'm trying to think what else you can do. Yeah, so it's cool that the game like has a lot of different mechanics that you can interact with, and you can kind of go in whatever direction you want to go in. Like all that seems good. The map is really good. There's a lot of varied both weather patterns and like kind of geographies, but it's all very like it feels very original. It feels like I haven't seen many of these types of settings in other games done before.
Mm-hmm.
So the timing and the location of it are all like very unique. And so they've done a good job of like creating that environment. It's a lot better than I expected. The missions are good too. Like the writing's not bad. Even though like a lot of these characters you're meeting in kind of like one-off missions, similar to like Grand Theft Auto, they do a good job of like creating, like telling what their motivation is like very quickly. Like, you know, you might hear like this sort of like tragic backstory from one character and that'll propel you in the next two missions. But you like, you kind of know what they've been through. And like the overarching setting is like people from Mongolia are invading Japan. So that kind of sets up all these like tragic tales in advance, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
But so far it's great. I interacted with the Kurosawa mode. Anytime I have a duel, I usually turn that on. It's pretty great. So it has black and white, but then it also has like a film grain over it. And then they also do tweaking with the audio. Where the audio, I don't know how to describe it because I'm not good with audio, but it just seems flatter.
They probably, basically like run some kind of emulation to make it sound like it is on some kind of older, like magnetic tape that would have run in a, that would have run alongside a projector. Yeah.
Yeah. So the only thing I can think of, it's awesome that they put that in the game because it's a very like well done mechanic. I typically haven't seen many other. I know like Uncharted would have like. I think they have like goofy filters that you could put in the game, where it's
Donut Drake, etc.
Well, there's that for the characters, but I thought there was one specifically for like filters of like tie dye filter or something like that, where it's like
lighting modes. Yes.
So I guess like other games have done this sort of thing as well. This one is very good because it's very tied in with the theming of the game. The only thing I wish is I wish that they would even tell you when are good times to turn it on or whatever. There's definitely some times where it might not be the best. There's like one duel you have specifically in this like purple flower region of the map that's like beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
But it's like, you probably don't want to turn on a black and white filter there, you know, like, but,
it's funny that they give you two aesthetically satisfying choices that by all accounts are both very, very impressive and worth seeing. And the tough part is choosing between them based on the situation.
Yeah. It's very nice that you can toggle between them. So it's very easy to turn one on and off, turn it on and off. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, what genre is this? Is this a Souls-like? Is it like a Ninja Gaiden?
It's like a Far Cry game. The combat's not as hard as Dark Souls. Yeah. But it's
so like a stealth game predominantly.
It can be similar. It has a better stealth system than like Far Cry does, where it's like you can sneak up on people, stab them in the back, that sort of thing. You can't really do so much as like dragging them places or whatever. So it's more like maybe it does feel similar to maybe like the Batman system, where it's like you can sneak up and knock out people when you're fighting. It's kind of more simplistic, like button pressing. Basically, you just have to dodge and time parries. They do a parry system, but it's not as like it's a very generous window that they give you, and it's basically like. You can unlock ability where there's like basically two types of parries. There's the actual parry, which is like if you perfectly time it, then they're like left open and you can attack them and like strike, get a free hit on them to the point where you can like pretty much kill them. The other parry is like has a much wider window, and basically you'll deflect their sword so they kind of like stumble, and then you can get like two shots on them, but then they'll be like guarded again pretty quickly. So like you basically either do that over and over again, or you land a perfect parry and like finish them off quickly. But it's like Batman in the sense that there's like four or five people around you, and you kind of have to like figure out which one's attacking you.
I mean, it sounds like, you know, it is a close neighbor to like Assassin's Creed to me.
Right. Yeah. It sounds like Shadow of War almost.
Yeah. And they do a good job too, where it's there'll be unblockable attacks and regular attacks. And those are almost like 50-50. It might be like 60-40 with the ones that you parry or whatever. So the other thing that you do is just like dodge attacks and then attack them after they miss. But then there's like a kind of like a timing game there, where it's like the people who are harder will like kind of surprisingly attack twice in close succession. And so you have to like figure that timing out. But it's telegraphed really well, where it's like the person attacking, there will be like a red dot on the sword that's like coming towards you. Nice. So it's like that part's very nice for somebody like me who's not used to that type of game. Trying to think what else I was going to say. I don't think it's going to be like the best game ever. It's not like a perfect game, but like it's a pretty enjoyable playthrough. I do think it's like the best version of like a Far Cry game that I've played. Nice. But the theming is really strong and completely unique in that sense. Which is a differentiating point. Also, once I turned the dialogue from English to Japanese with subtitles, that improved my experience a whole bunch. The thing is, I don't know if it's bad Japanese voice acting. The English voice acting is fine, but it's like it's much better with Japanese voice and subtitles.
Did you probably pick apart the vocal performance in a language you do not necessarily know? Like you pick it apart less than if you know the if you know it. Yeah,
it feels much more immersive as well. I think it's one of the things where it's like I think they probably build this as more of like a AAA American type game because it would probably sell better. But you can actually make it like a more like a game that's set in Japan and is like completely Japanese, you know? I'm enjoying it so far. I'm going to keep playing it. I'll probably see it through. It seems like the map, there's like maybe four or five sections to it. I'm only on the first one. So I still think I'm at the early stages of it, but
I'm happy that you found that there was more to it here.
Yeah, I still think that they kind of started the game on the wrong foot, where they tried to make it very like Uncharted-esque, where it's like following people around and like crawling through spaces.
Right. And that's not what it is at all.
Yeah. And then you don't see any of that stuff for the rest of the game once you're put in the open world, except for very rarely. So,
yeah. Nice. Mm-hmm. Does anybody else have questions about Ghost of Tsushima?
No, I'll be interesting when you get to that point of like, all right, I've finished the story. Now it's time for the 100% grind.
I see. I think it's going to go in the other direction where I think I'm going to upgrade everything that I want to upgrade. And then I'm still only like halfway through the game. So I have to try and like beeline through the story. I feel like it'll be like that, but we'll see.
Yeah. For people who are interested, Tsushima is a game that is very hard to say with my current tongue situation.
We found one.
Multiplayer.
Now it is time for the multiplayer, where we ask you a question and then you answer it. Dennis, what is the question you ask the nice people?
Yeah, I wanted to know where in games have they done a really good job taking something traditionally gamey, health bars or certain mechanics, and made it diegetic. And kind of had a really good reason for that thing to be in the game beyond it's a game.
Yeah. And the image that you chose for this is a good answer in and of itself. The kind of health display on the back of the armor in Dead Space. Yeah. So I'll get us started here with Ollie, who says, this is definitely something that I know annoys a lot of people, but I like how some games have used a really simple mechanic to pan out game time. Encumbrance. Let's admit it, we love loot, and it's hard not to Pokemon it when playing something that allows you to pick up a bunch of stuff. But those crafty devs gave those little trinkets and found swords weight. So we need to find a place to leave them or sell them for cash. And this adds extra semi-realistic elements to a game, and I just kind of love it. Plus, becoming over-encumbered and picking up a ring always reminds me of this ad for Australian beer. Don't overdo the sherry. I did not watch that ad for Australian beer. I assume that last line is related to that commercial.
They load up a pickup truck, and then just two more bottles is enough to make it collapse.
Ah, gotcha. Yeah,
sounds like Australia.
Yeah, no, I like that making it a trade off. It's not always a good thing to buy to get a new thing. Yeah,
make that game NP hard.
Ben, what does Patrick say?
Patrick says the Portal 2 movement tutorial comes to mind. It has you being told you were in suspended animation and that you need to do mandatory exercise. Then it has you look up and look down. You are told to walk. Then you are told to walk and stare at art, and you have to move around.
Yeah. Yep, that's very good. Like, it is such an immediate sense of like how funny this game is going to be.
Yeah.
Yeah. Very good. Just the fact that you're in a shitty hotel room, or what looks like a shitty hotel room. It's mm-hmm. very good. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Let's see, David, what does Greg say?
Greg says the tutorials in recent Madden games have done a great job of not only getting you through how to toss the ball and connect with the receiver, but also explain for those new to the game of football how things work, quote unquote, and how what you are doing on screen relates to real life. For example, short throws are going to be bullets with a low arc and a lot of power, so you hold the button down to do it quick. Long throws are arcs that depend on timing and angle more than power, so you take more time to focus on the throw with a longer pass mechanic and lightly tap the button. Still won't help me be an NFL quarterback, but I understand the position better thanks to the game.
Nice.
This made me realize that they, at least on some level, are designing the tutorials of Madden for someone who is not familiar at all with football. And that is a fascinating challenge.
Yeah.
Like that is really, I kind of like just want to play the tutorial for that alone.
I'm having a very tough time imagining the person who does not know what football is, but is willing to go in on Madden at this point.
You know, it's happened, and that makes me happy.
Let's see. Dennis, what does Dan say?
Dan says The Witcher 3 has a good tutorial that builds up the relationships with key characters in the game and starts Geralt's fantastic demeanor. A great start to a great game. Close second was the Vitomatic Vigor Tester in Fallout New Vegas. I need that reference explained for sure.
I forget what that is, actually.
So basically, the way you assign your special stats is set up to be like one of those penny arcade machines where it's like, you know, test your grip and like, oh, you
oh, that's great.
Are, you know, 10 on the Love-O-Meter, you know, mm-hmm. that sort of thing.
Yeah, it's in the doctor's office. All I remember is like that machinery looks exactly like the cigarette machines and the old Denny's in Ontario used to look like.
Yep.
Yeah. That is for me and David.
I love the all of the alternate dialogue from that. If mm-hmm. you have like really, really high or really, really low in a stat, you'll make different commentary.
Mm-hmm. Huh. Yeah. Gosh, low intelligence runs. I know they're problematic, but they're very fun in specifically Fallout 2 in New Vegas.
And the Outer Worlds.
Yeah. Callum writes, respawning in Bioshock 1 and 2. Yeah, the Vita chambers and like the way that they are low-key a spoiler for who you might actually be. It's so really neat how they intertwine that.
I still really want them to come back with and canonize the plot hole this creates at the end of the game where, I guess, spoiler for a however many old game, you kill Andrew Ryan and he presumably immediately respawns like in the next room.
Yeah.
No, it was in a cutscene. They don't work during cutscenes.
Nope. No,
except that this is literally this same cutscene where he explains that the Vita chambers are in world.
Nice. That is very funny. I never thought of that. Let's see. Ben, what does Alexander say?
Alexander says, in Resident Evil Revelations 2, Claire is grabbed by an evil group and they put a biomonitor type device on her. The old green, orange, red that you use to get on the menu screen is always present on your character model in the game. A very cool diegetic upgrade to something that up to the point had been in pure gaminess.
Yeah. Then they did something similar with RE7.
So this obviously is not what he meant, but I'm just imagining... He says diegetic. I'm imagining like the Dianetics, the PK meters, or whatever they're called.
Yeah, Resident Evil. It is actually a big recruitment thing for the Church of Scientology. Yeah, that'd be miserable. I would hate that. I would hate it if that were true. let's see here. David, what does David say?
David says, I'm a sucker for playing a game that's about playing a game. See your .hack games and more recently CrossCode. So them being able to talk about menus and quests and level ups and the like without technically breaking the fourth wall is something I get a kick out of. Yeah, I remember that was great playing the Matrix MMO because, mm-hmm. When you're going to log off, you just are like, yeah, I'm going to jack out for a while.
Yeah.
Just don't confuse jack out and log off.
Yeah, I heard Ben laugh. I heard him suppress a chuckle at that. That was very fun. let's see. Dennis, what does Rookie say?
Rookie says, I enjoyed how Dead Space took just about every menu and turned it into in-universe menus that Isaac used to interact with things. I'm also a sucker for diegetic health bars like the energy meter Isaac had at the back of his suit. Even though it made no sense to put it where he'd need like three mirrors to show how much energy he had left.
So yeah. I saw this.
I hadn't thought about that piece.
there are lights on the front that he can see and he can obviously, tell if he's about to, die. The description that I heard was it is prominent on the back because engineers often work in teams and they need to know, like, it is useful to know like what the other person's status is specifically for like oxygen and stuff.
It also feels just like a battery. I guess maybe he'd want to see it, but
yeah.
I guess trespasser with the boobiometer.
God damn it, David. Sorry, you took my answer. We'll take it. I'll justify it later. I'm not actually angry at you. It was just very funny to yell.
That's good.
Oh, geez. Tim writes, this makes me think of the elevators in the first Mass Effect game. I believe that they were really just the loading screens for the next area of the map, which was an interesting way to hide them. But they were so darn slow. When there are mass relays, you can transport spaceships thousands millions of light years instantaneously, but I have to wait about 5 minutes to get to the next floor of the Citadel. I think there is a problem. Yeah, they should have really accounted for the fact that like that would vary system for system. They covered that with incidental dialogue, but it wasn't enough. Yeah, not enough.
So they had to replace it with awkward silence dialogue.
Yeah.
Game really weird.
Just give you time to think about how these characters are slightly in the Uncanny Valley.
And that's why you could sleep with all your teammates in that game.
Yeah, it was wise of them to just use loading screens in the next games.
Wait, in the elevator?
I think.
No, sleep, I mean, sleep with your teammates?
Oh, like the Aerosmith song, Love in an Elevator?
Yeah. You have to have the awkward conversations in the elevator, so sleeping with them there is optional.
Hmm. Also, how dare you use the A word?
Awkward?
No.
Aerosmith? Okay, sorry. Didn't know that was a nerve.
Doesn't hurt to say it. Hurts to hear it.
Ben, round us out. What does John say?
John says, in Dragon's Dogma, I like the way you can give yourself more carry weight by making a bigger avatar, or be faster and slip into tight spaces by making a smaller one. It could have been another couple of meters to fill up as you gain experience, but it was neat how they tied it to your actual physicality.
Yeah.
I think I'm going to tangent. I think there's a multiplayer game or an idea for a game where it's like when you shoot other people, you gain mass and they lose mass.
Oh.
And then like your traversal of the environment is affected when you do that.
Huh. I've not heard of a game like that.
It is like you can shoot their feet and eventually their feet get huge and then it has a mechanical impact and like then they can kick you across the map. I know exactly what you're talking about. I cannot for the life of me think of the name.
Yeah.
Yep.
Let's go through ours real quick. Mine is the boob health meter in Trespasser, not because it's a good thing, but actually because it is a very good anti-pattern and also serves as a marker of like, okay, guys, this is the worst thing. This is the worst we could have done. Let's mark progress from here. So the idea is like, you know, Trespasser was supposed to be this really immersive game with, you know, with everything being determined by physics, etc. And they wanted to get away with not having any on-screen meters. So an on-screen health meter was, you know, out of the question. But you still needed to, you know, tell your health, when like you were not in a third person camera and couldn't like change the animation or whatever. So you would look down and your character, who is, a gifted female, let's say, on her breast, next to her prominently displayed cleavage, there is a heart tattoo that acts as your health meter. So when you're at full health, it is full red, and then it drains as you take more damage.
Which a tattoo that actively changes is just as breaking as anything else you could slap on the screen.
But in this one, you get to look between two titties.
Yeah, no, not butt, breasts.
just to make sure that it's clear. It was one of the first times I really encountered a way for a game to hide its meters, and it was so clunky. I mean, I appreciated it as a 12-year-old kid when I played it. I was like, oh, that rules, but it's, you know, probably not the best practices, and we can mark progress against that.
Although, hide the meters by showing everything else.
Other than that, a fairly revolutionary game in terms of its, you know, mechanics and technology.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. No doubt.
Was this the one that did like dynamic sound creation by mixing? Mm-hmm. Okay. Yep. Okay. Yep.
Yeah. It was too ambitious. It could not fulfill what it needed to, but it tried. Damn it. Ben, how about you?
Yeah, this one's like not like realistic what they did, but I'm going to say it. I'm just going to throw out the Call of Duty Modern Warfare games where they're just like, we're not going to have somebody worry about health. Like, we'll just display red blood over their eyes as they're like, hey, about to die. Yeah. But that'll go away and they'll be back to 100%. Mm-hmm. I think it's good. The fact that they just got rid of a health meter I thought was really good. Like, you don't need to really micromanage or like look at the numbers or anything like that. Yeah,
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I thought you were going to say the fish physics.
Fish physics? And which one?
I don't know. Which one was that?
I think you mean the fishics.
Yes, the fish.
I need more information. I can't pick down what
so
that is.
So one of them, during their E3, they made a big deal out of the fact that, like, Azure, Snake Eater was, swimming, I don't know, to wherever he did, like, the fish, schools of fish would react to you and, like, swim away in a realistic manner. It just became infamous for just being a dumb, like, non-feature.
Yeah, an extravagance, let's say. Extravagance, also a difficult word to say. David, how about you?
So I think for me, mine is definitely games that give a in-world reason for why your character keeps coming back to life.
Okay, so like the Vita Chambers.
Vita Chambers, or I think one of the most effective instances of it is the Dark Souls.
Yeah, the Curse
series. The reason for me is because I feel like otherwise, dying kind of in some ways cheapens the story, because it's like, I don't know, it's fairly easy to be the hero when, like, you can just keep trying until you, might manage to get lucky. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, especially something like Dark Souls kind of flips the script. Mm-hmm. Where the entire point is that your heroism is the fact that you go through, just dying over and over again.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, I think that's something I would like to see in more games.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And Dennis, round us out.
Yeah. So just there, you made me think of, I believe Prince of Persia 2, where if you die, he's like, no, sorry, I'm telling the story wrong.
Yeah. Sands of Time. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Although if you told a story like that, just like, and then I died, I was, my body was limp upon the spikes. No, wait, no, that's not how it turned out. I'm here telling the story now. Anyway, I would not have very much, like, patience for that person.
The douchey kids from the age of not.
Yep.
Which is, literally every sentence is some a lie with not and then the truth.
So
for me, there were two that came to mind. The first is in Little Big Planet, because it's a game where people are creating levels, and it's very easy to have situations where you are stuck and can't make progress. They've built in a reset button to mm-hmm. reset you to the latest checkpoint, only instead of just, resetting, your little sack boy squeezes and flexes until he pops. and that, the kind of cutest little reset that you've ever seen.
Mm-hmm.
In a way to make that a little more delightful. And then the second one is in the Uncharted games, your health and the eventually dying. It seems like a break that, Nathan Drake could eat so many bullets over the course of a game. However, it was revealed or someone pointed out that if you watch, he never actually gets hit by anything
mm-hmm.
until the bullet that kills him.
Yeah.
And they'll make the screen go darker and stuff like that, like more ominous.
Mm-hmm.
But really that represents his luck running out.
Yeah.
And so he's taking the normal amount of damage, which is zero, before he's caught by a bullet and then dies.
Yeah. That was, I mean, that's a relatively older kind of interpretation of what hit points means, mm-hmm. whether it's actually like how much blood you have in your body, or if it's your, your willingness to go on, et cetera. Like, this represents your luck is a common one that I've heard or seen.
It's actually a really good breakdown of particularly like, the D20 system hit points, basically mm-hmm. arguing that it's mostly your character's ability to roll with the punches and turn like a lethal attack into merely an injurious one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm always down for hearing that. I've been on a big kick of reading like RPG source books recently, and I love like honing in on that on that description, how they conceptualize it.
As a side note, if you want a really good one, check out Veins of the Earth.
Okay.
It's basically like, what if the Underdark accepts survival horror?
Mm-hmm. Oh. Hmm. Okay. Yep. You know how to pitch something to me. Cool. Well, thank you, everybody, for writing in. If you would like to participate in these in the future, you can go to facebook.com/thelevelpodcast. And those go up on Monday afternoons. And thank you, Dennis, for posting this.
Mm-hmm.
The end boss.
And now it is time for the end boss, where we talk about things that are happening in the world of video games around us. I'm going to lead here tonight because I am super excited about this story. There have been a lot of leaks that have come out of Nintendo here in recent years, mostly relating to older games.
Seems you know, like they need a plumber.
that's good. I like that. this is, you know, so yes, mostly about older games. However, this is the big one, folks, and this is less of like a singular story and more of just something to pay attention to. But the big one happened here just like last week. Fans are calling it the Giga Leak, and this is just a whole bunch of development data from Nintendo games, specifically spanning the Super Nintendo and N64 eras. There are so many cool things that I do not feel confident to make like a list of them here for you. Things yeah, from
you could,
like
you could lose afternoons to this.
Yeah, like this is like there's so many people combing through this and surfacing like amazing things. Like I am enamored with that sprite sheet of like side-scrolling Link from an alternate version of Zelda 3. That people are assuming was like a Zelda 2 remake. There are full resolution assets of 3D, like 3D models that, you know, were otherwise turned low resolution or made low res for manuals. But here they are kind of in their full, like high res glory. There are like uncompressed voice samples from Mario games in here. So like all of that, like mushy low bitrate let's go that like you associate the like the original recordings that were then compressed so they could fit and be played on the cartridges.
It's like someone with a New York accent, like, hey, let's get out of here.
But it's like just amazing to hear it in full clarity, like, oh my god, that was the performance. Yeah, awesome. like all of the versions that like Yoshi went through, like all of the awkward ones that they like rejected before they got to the good one. yeah, you know, and this is controversial. People are saying like, yeah, this is actually like not good for archival purposes. Like all this is going to do is make companies like Nintendo more apt to buckle down or what have you. And that's a conversation, you know, to have. I am currently of the position that this is an amazing treasure that we have found, because I love these games so much. Nintendo is already so tight-lipped, and to see these imperfect things that are usually like sanded off by the time everything comes to release is, you know, not something I ever expected to have happen. So
yeah. See, I feel like a conversation implies two people talking as opposed to the fans talking and Nintendo saying fuck you.
So like I have seen people say like, yeah, it's not as cut and dry, you know, like to report on this. And there are some things like there's some personal information in the corpus of data that was put out. You know, all of this is from 20-30 years ago. I cannot and will not speak to whether or not that makes it any better or worse. You know, it's not my information. I probably wouldn't want that stuff to be out there, but that is not the stuff that I've seen surfaced, let's say.
I liked one of the details in the article of like a dev seeing the tool that he made for like a text editor in Star Fox.
Oh, yeah.
From like 30 years ago. That's adorable.
Yeah.
Nothing is ever truly gone. Sometimes in a good way.
Yeah. No, but it's just been, it's been wonderful. And, you know, I get the sense that we are kind of only at the, only at the top of this. Like, you know, we're going to be seeing a lot more stuff as people dig deeper. Like, it took a couple of days for people to find the 3D model for Luigi in Mario 64. Like, that was a, that was an urban legend. Like, people said, oh, Luigi's here because we saw XYZ, you know, preview coverage of the game, you know, so like, let's do everything we can on the game, try and find it. Here's this code, here's that code, etc. People wrote it off saying, no, it's not there. Boom, here's a model for Luigi. It's there. It's confirmed.
Mm-hmm.
Love it.
Luigi confirmed. Like, imagine what we could do if we directed that sort of work elsewhere.
Yeah. Something like that.
Oh, I am so, yeah. This just every new tweet that I see with some goofy ass image. Yeah, buoys my spirits. Yeah. So let's see here. David, how about you? What story did you bring?
Yeah, so I found a article that is kind of interesting. It was someone doing an in-depth analysis to try to answer the question, is every game of Slay the Spire winnable? Ooh. So he starts out by pointing out that that's actually could be one of two questions. The first question could be, for every game of Slay the Spire, if you made the right choice at each point you had a choice to make, mm-hmm. would you win? Or the other would be, are there certain runs for which, like, no combination of choices can end up at win? And the example he gives is, like, in Minesweeper, where, you know, Every game is winnable, but there will be situations where you simply have to guess.
Yeah.
So, and he basically points out that, you know, it would be difficult, bordering on impossible, to prove what a perfect game of Slay the Spire is. Yeah. However, if you look at, like, high-end players, they apparently win about 99% of the time.
Mm-hmm.
Which is nuts, by the way. Or is that on Ascension mode or regular mode?
I think that's on low Ascension, and I wanted to say maybe it drops to, like, 50%, maybe, on, like, was it Ascension 20 or something?
Yeah, I'm looking at Ascension 20. The win rate kind of varies pretty wildly, depending on which character you tend to run as low as 75 for Ironclad and 96% for the Watcher. So
okay. Yeah. And then he then turns to the question of, like, are there any seeds for which it would be impossible to win? And basically he concludes, and Ben, you might need to translate this some.
Yeah.
He goes with a Ascension 20 and some sort of special run that I don't have in front of me what it's called right now. Whoever is, you know, one of the variant rule runs that's apparently the most, the, you know, most difficult one, mm-hmm. I guess.
Lagavulin or whatever. Maybe that's the one that, like, dies after 5 turns.
Yeah. And apparently is playing as Silent, which is that a character?
Yeah, that's the green character. It's the defensive build. Oh, okay, yeah.
Yeah.
The monster he's talking about is from the first map. It's the one that looks kind of like an egg.
Okay.
And is an asshole.
So, and basically what he points out is with Silent, with your starting deck, it is literally impossible to kill that character, that boss, because you simply can't do enough damage.
Yeah, you have to attack it very quickly.
Right. And it's basically, there could conceivably within the rule set be a seed where you never get anything that increases your damage before that point.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So basically, he goes to, he's currently looking to see if such a seed actually exists.
And then he's going to demand a refund.
But it at the very least appears plausible. So yeah, that might have been a whole bunch of math just to like miss the entire point of a game. But, you know.
You know that like somebody playing in this space is serious when they publish this as a document on GitHub and not on any other platform.
Yep. Yeah, it's not a Polygon article. I was going to say that too. It kind of speaks to the fact that there's a lot of people who really enjoy playing this game, myself included.
Yeah,
like well past beating it for the first time.
I didn't know that there was a boss named Lagavulin, and I would not be able to fight him without thinking about very delicious whiskey.
Yeah, I searched for it and just saw alcohol. Like,
oh. Well, it's saying this, that's what you need at this point.
Yeah.
To get your strength up? Yeah.
Maybe. Get the courage. Dennis, what's going on with Paper Mario?
Yeah, well, first off, I didn't realize Paper Mario snuck another game out
there. They did, so yeah. It's getting good reviews.
That's pretty sweet. Mm-hmm. Yes, although it is also apparently very, very difficult, mm-hmm. which is a positive thing in mm-hmm. my mind. But also they've discovered that towards the end of the game, you can just brick your run by walking out the wrong door at the wrong time.
Good to know.
That does sound difficult.
Yeah, heads up. So this is bad. I don't know how this got through. Basically, you know, at a certain point, you get a special pass to go into an area that you haven't been able to get into before. And if you go into that area and promptly leave, it will take the pass, but not register that you've gone Uh-oh. In and ask you for the pass again with no way to get the pass. Yeah. So I imagine this is going to be, going to be patched quickly.
Yeah.
But people who have gotten to that point and made that mistake are stuck kind of just waiting for that to happen, or stuck starting over from scratch
because
there's no way around it.
Yeah.
Because it auto saves when you walk the wrong direction. So yeah.
No.
That bad.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that really, this is just an excuse for me to talk about the Origami King being a thing and mm-hmm. me being excited for it. I will remind you that Jen is the one who's primarily been into Paper Mario before. And in the last one she played, she came across like the end game dungeon run boss tower. It's like 100 floors of, uh-huh. of madness or whatever. You know, and you come across that, I won't say relatively early in the game, but well before the point where you should actually attempt it. Mm-hmm. She decided that she was not moving any further in the game until
oh god I think I know which one this is, like the flip side dungeon in Super Paper Mario on the Wii.
Correct.
Yeah.
And so reading this and being like, ooh, difficult combat, like yes,
this perhaps will be a thing that she's into. Yeah.
Yes, I can't wait to plant that seed and watch it grow. So yeah. Yeah, just we will make sure not to hit this game ending bug.
Yeah, wait a week. Wait a week or two. Mm-hmm. Probably it'll be fixed. It might be fixed now.
Hopefully by the time you guys are listening to this.
Yeah. Nice. And Ben, do you have a story?
I don't, but I have a segue that I was going to talk about because Dennis' story reminded me of something else that I watch. I'll sometimes watch like behind the scenes like game development videos talking about like the process of making games. And there's one with Stardew Valley where they mentioned something similar happening. It's just made by the one guy who lives in like the Pacific Northwest area, Seattle/Tacoma-ish. But he found a game-breaking bug like the day he was going to ship the game. And so he like, I guess it was like the night before or whatever. So he stayed up all night programming, trying to fix it. And he successfully did before shipping it out.
Oh, wow. So
this is a thing that can happen at all mm-hmm. levels of game development.
So. I can't imagine how stressful that would be.
Yep.
Yeah.
Nice.
Well, how do you all feel about buttoning it up?
Let us buttons.
Thank you so much, everybody, for listening to this episode of The Level. I really appreciate it. All I can think of by way of promotion is that our the audio from Duckfest 2020 is going to be available for sale, should be this week. selling that again to benefit the same cause, Color of Change. So you can go in there and listen to not just a new episode, you know, like a new episode of this show, but a bunch of other things. That was a very fun weekend, and this is a way to bottle it up for folks. Yeah, there's that, and then there's also the usual stuff: Patreon, iTunes reviews, all of those kinds of things. Is there anything I'm forgetting?
No, sounds good to me.
Okay. Yeah, so I've been Cole Ross. You can see my tweets on Twitter at Cole Ross.
I've been Dennis Furia. You can find me on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter at Deck of Wonders. You just have to put underscores between the words on Twitter.
Cool.
I'm David Meismith. You can find me as long as you social distancing afterwards.
Yeah.
Does that mean that they can come to you and greet you within 6 feet when they greet you? But
No. Once they find me, they then need to only approach to within 6 feet.
You will not.
So if they blindfold themselves, they can get within 6 feet of you.
Well,
take
the
blindfold off and then run away.
Because if you have your eyes closed, the virus can't see you.
Mm-hmm. That's the law.
You got this on Fox News, I take it? Okay, so I've been Ben Merkel. You can find Jalachan at Jalachan in places. I was going to say this earlier when Dennis was making a joke about getting video game news source. I thought about saying Star Fox News, and it never came to pass.
Oh, yeah. I like that. Yeah.
That's all I got.
Okay. And stick around for some titles. Okay, I only have one. I have the Universe Box.
That's good.
Who else has them?
I've got four.
Okay.
Ooh.
I've got It's Gonna Be Goopy. The Numbers Are the Quest.
Ooh.
I have Fishix.
Okay.
And then I have Luigi Confirmed.
Okay.
So I had one. I had, let's get out of here.
Hey, let's get out of here. Yeah, okay.
I have two titles, and they kind of are, they're not supposed to be related, but they're kind of related. So the first one is The Extravagance of Tsushima, because it's really painful for Cole to say.
Okay, cool.
And then the other one I have is Life is Pain.
Oh, yeah.
That is a 2020 approved title.
Yes. The one that got the strongest reaction was It's Going to Be Goopy.
I kind of like that one.
Yeah.
I did too.
Okay.
Thematically appropriate.
Okay, cool. Awesome. Well, I'm going to go. I have had a long day. I'm going to spend the rest of it in bed.
Sleep is precious.
Yeah.
Playing Sudoku.
Probably for about 20 minutes.
There you go. We've crossed paths, by the way. I play Picross now and you play Sudoku.
Ooh, yeah. Nice. Yeah.
I am eternally disappointed that Picross does not involve Pikmin.
There might be a Pikmin puzzle in Picross. No, well.
I mean, it's spelled with a C and not a K, so.
Yes.
That's on you, David.
Which one is Pikmin spelled with?
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Cool. All right. Take care, you guys. Be safe, please.
Yeah, have a good week.
Congratulations, Dennis.
Yeah. Oh, thank you. Thank you.
Bye.
All right. See you guys.
Bye.
Peace, y'all.